Welcome to MTG Pro Tutor, your gathering of insights, tips, and advice from renowned players and community icons. Connect with venerated teachers to gain the knowledge you need to improve your skills. Now, here's your planar guide and personal tutor, Sean Penrod.
Welcome to episode 194 of the MTG Pro Tutor Podcast. I'm Sean Penrod, your host. So happy you are joining us today. This episode is brought to you by the patrons and by the Deck Building Masterclass. If you are interested in supporting the show directly, you can go to mtgpro2.com/Patreon and learn more about that. Basically, Patreon is a great way for you to give back to the creators that you care about. You can pledge any amount you want per episode, and then you can set a monthly limit so that you never go out of budget. The show will always be free. This is just an optional way that you can give back if you choose. And as a thank you each and every month, I love doing a patron-exclusive giveaway where I will pick one random patron and give them some Magic-related products. So that's always a lot of fun for me. I love doing that. I love seeing what the patrons get. And the bottom line of that is because I am so grateful for your support. It really means a lot to me. The patrons are what help keep the show going. So mtgpro2.com/Patreon is where you can go to check that out. The other sponsor, as I mentioned, is the Deck Building Masterclass. This is an amazing series that I put together with three of the best deck builders in the industry. And you can get the free PDF download at deckbuildingmasterclass.com. It walks through the EDH test. That's evaluate, determine, hypothesize, and test. Basically, it's an in-depth analysis of how to evaluate the metagame, determine what the trends are and how to attack it, and then test your ideas so you can show up to your event ready to win. Deckbuildingmasterclass.com is where you can go to get the free PDF download for that. So check that out. How was your pre-release last weekend? I had a blast at mine. I went to Paragon City Games. They are an amazing store. Cannot wait to do more events there. And just had a great time over the weekend. I did a Modern Masters draft for Friday Night Magic, and then hung out and did the pre-release, and Amonkhet is really fun. I think it's going to be a great set. I'm really excited to get back into Standard right now, and I really look forward to doing more limited events. So tell me about your pre-release. I would love to hear about it. Hop into the Facebook group and tell us what you learned, what you found out about the cards, which ones were good, which ones were bad. Let's start figuring out this format together. Well, that's really it for the top of the interview stuff. We have a great guest lined up for you today. So without further ado, let's sit down and talk about Magic. What's up, everybody? I'm super excited to have our guest with us today. Our guest is a new face on the Pro Tour as he just made his first Grand Prix Top 8 at Utrecht in 2017. Coming to us from Copenhagen, Denmark, prodigies near and far, let's welcome the one, the only, Casper Nielsen. Casper, how are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm doing good.
Excellent. Are you ready to delve into your mind and share with the audience tips and tricks to take their game to the next level?
Yeah, for sure.
Excellent. Now, prodigies, if you want to connect with Casper, you can do so on Twitter. He's at @KS_Nielsen, so you can find him there. And Casper, tell us what you have going on out there in Denmark. Are you a student? Do you work? Is Magic your full-time thing?
No, I work full-time. I work like 40 hours a week.
Oh, wow. What do you do?
I sell cutting tools for basically like huge factories, like cutting tools that cut into all sorts of metal.
Wow. And wow. Oh, that's awesome. That's fascinating. I've never met anybody who does that, so that's really cool.
No, it's a very specialized, very small field.
A very small field. And it's just there locally in Denmark?
Yeah, we like basically what we do is that we have providers from outside of Denmark, some from Japan, some from Germany, stuff like that, and we sell their products in Denmark. So we're sort of a middle link in between the actual producer of the tools and the users of the tools.
Excellent. So where and how does Magic fit into all of that? Like, we would love to hear, you know, your origin story. So take us back in time. Tell us the story of the first time you ever saw or played with Magic cards.
It was a birthday party. I was 13 years old, I think, maybe 12. And my cousins brought some cards that I'd never seen before. And I was like, what is this? This looks kind of interesting. I'd been a geek. I've been a geek my entire life, so I was like, okay, this seems interesting. Like, how does this work? Turns out I had another pair of cousins who also played this game. So what basically happened was that I got introduced to it, and my aunt and uncle went, hey, for Casper's birthday, we're gonna take him to the local game store. We're gonna buy him some booster packs. We're gonna give him a couple of singles, and just let him run with it as he pleases.
Awesome. That's a good pair of aunt and uncle right there.
Yeah, that was good. So I played for a couple of years, well, quite a few years, actually, and I got pretty good. I made 2 PTQ finals as a kid, lost both of them. I was really good friends with other known Danish players from back then, Rasmus Seebest and Thomas Enevoldsen, and like the players that were the best in Denmark back then.
Mm-hmm.
And then I turned 18 and poker sort of happened.
Oh, okay.
So like all the other Magic players in Denmark, more or less, I went into poker for a while. I didn't make big bucks, but I made enough money to have a better living than I, for instance, have now from my current job.
Okay.
So I went into that for a while, kind of hated it, which was weird, but what can you do? And then, quite frankly, what happened is one day I turned on Twitch TV to watch a League of Legends stream, and I happened to see Magic coverage on the front page. And I go, oh, that seems interesting. I wonder what that is, because I've never seen that before. And I used to play a lot of Magic as a kid, so I was like, okay, let's see this. And I click onto it, and what I see is GP Strasbourg 2011 or 12.
Okay.
And it's the quarterfinals, and my friend Thomas Ennevaldsen is playing. So I'm like, oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that guy still played Magic.
that's cool.
So I sit there watching this, and I go like, you know what? I actually miss playing this game. So I download Magic Online, open my old Magic Online account, had a bunch of cards, sold some of them, played a Gatecrash draft, went 3-0, and then I was hooked again.
Oh, nice. I came back with a bang. That's cool. That's a good story. So what was your very first set when you came back, when you came in the first time?
I remember the first booster pack I ever got was a Tempest booster pack. And I remember it very vividly because I was very excited about a green card named the Kraklin, I think. It's like a green X creature that can regenerate or something. And to my kid mind, that was just the coolest thing ever because it could be however big and it could regenerate and just, oh, it was awesome. And it, obviously it turned out the card was garbage. But
that's funny. That is funny. Oh, I just love, you know, remembering all of the, you know, the old stuff that we liked back in the day and all that. No, that's just fun. That's just really fun. So do you have a favorite set?
I don't really know, actually. I have a set that I like the least.
Oh, nice. Which one's that?
Which was Theros.
Okay.
That was really, yeah. And I played a lot of Mono Blue Devotion, and I did very well with Mono Blue Devotion in all aspects of Magic. That was when I played my first GP after coming back in Theros. And I remember it very vividly because I went to GP Vienna in 2014, I think, or 13 maybe. And I lost round 15 at 12-2 to Oliver Pollack-Rotman, playing the Mono Blue Devotion Mirror for top 8. And the day before, in round 5 of the Grand Prix trial, because I didn't have enough Planeswalker points for 2 buys, I had lost 2-0 to Oliver Pollack-Rotman.
No way! Oh man, that's funny. Oh man.
But yeah, I came back then, and then I was hooked, then I had a few health problems underway. So I was sort of off the GP trips for a while.
Okay.
And yeah, then about 2 years ago, I was declared healthy again. And I got myself a job. I got myself the financial situation to really put effort into Magic in my spare time.
Nice. And it's paying off.
Yeah.
Great. So, oh, and I can't wait to dive into that a little bit more. What is one of your favorite cards?
One of my favorite cards? I don't know, man. I think Snapcaster Mage is just my favorite card.
Excellent. So for those of us who don't know, what is that card? What does it do? And why do you like it?
It's a 2/1 creature for 1 generic and 1 blue mana. It has flash, and when it enters the battlefield, you may target a instant or sorcery card in your graveyard, and it will gain flashback until end of turn.
Perfect.
Tiago Chan's invitational card.
Yes. Good stuff. And do you have any cool stories with that? Did you win something big off of that, or you just like the design?
Not really. It was just what I did when I came back to Magic, basically, because what then happened was after I played Magic Online for a while, I sort of played Magic Online a little bit, and then all of a sudden, out of the blue, one of my other friends goes like, hey, Casper, you played like a lot of Magic when you were a kid, right? And I was like, well, yeah, you knew that. It's like, yeah, one of my friends is like playing Magic like really casually, right? And she was like, well, we'd love to play with you. It'd be awesome. And I was like, dude, you don't want to do that. Because I'm not very good at casual stuff.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense. I don't do casual very well. So what basically happened was that he brought over a couple of really weak decks for some whatever thing we were doing one night, watching a movie or whatever. We played a couple of games. I beat him with his own decks because I knew Magic fundamentals better than he did. And I was like, okay, if you want to really play Magic, I happened to have been investigating that M14 was coming out. Mm-hmm. I was like, if you want to play Magic, we're going to go to a pre-release. And you're going to try playing sanctioned Magic. Not high-level Magic, but sanctioned Magic. So what happens is we go to a pre-release weekend, we play a bunch of pre-releases, and I meet a couple of really nice local dudes who go like, hey, you should show up to F&Ms and stuff. And I was like, oh, that sounds fun, but I'm not really into like throwing multiple hundreds of dollars into buying Magic cards like right now. And one of the dudes that I've, by the way, never met before this weekend just goes, that's not a problem. I practically own all cards that are standard legal at this point. You can borrow pretty much whatever from me.
That's so nice. That's awesome.
Yeah, and I was like, wow, that's extremely generous. You seem like a pretty awesome guy.
Wow, that's cool.
So basically I showed up at an F. I watched some Star City Opens and such in the meantime and actually got acquainted with the standard development. So I showed up to an F&M. I was like, do you have like the blue, white, red flash cards? And he was like, yeah, yeah. And he mainly played black, green, and white cards, so he didn't have a problem with it. So I basically borrowed a full blue, white, red flash deck and I think I made some enemies the first couple of times I was there, actually.
Oh, man, as it goes. I think that's really neat. I love how, you know, just the community is just so friendly and giving. And but one thing that you mentioned is you were talking about how you're playing with your friend and you beat him with his own decks because you understood Magic fundamentals better. What are some of those fundamentals? Like, what did you understand? And, you know, because we've heard that before, too, and kind of depending on what level you're at, whether the casual level or competitive level, the player who understands things a little bit better will normally have an edge. So what are some of those fundamentals that you feel are really important?
I think some of the fundamentals is just to understand the pacing of a Magic game.
Okay.
I think that a lot of people seem to have trouble with, like, there are situations where mana efficiency is the most important thing, where tempo is the most important thing, where dealing with card X is the most important thing. And just knowing sort of how to weigh all those things is what I consider the most important fundamentals.
And so I love that. I love that distinction. How do you know when what thing is important? You know, like just kind of get a feel for it as you go, or are there some kind of indicators? Or
I don't really think that there's any exchange here except for experience.
Yeah.
I think that it comes with playing hundreds and hundreds of games.
Yeah.
I think that no matter who you are, if you're looking to get better and you're willing to like look at what you're doing and consider like, would it have been better to do this or would it have been better to do that and do it not in just the situation specific situation, but looking at the whole sort of sample of what could have happened. I think that if you're willing to look at it in that way and say, I made the right play, it lost me the game, but it was the right play.
Mm-hmm.
Or I made the wrong play, it won me the game. More important, actually. I made the wrong play, it happened to win me the game, but there was a whole slew of situations where it would have lost me the game.
Interesting. I think that's a much better way of putting it. Rather than saying, oh, like, when do you know when what thing is important? The key is really, like you said, experience, and then asking those questions so that you can become familiar with, oh, hey, in this game, this creature was important, or in this game, tempo was important. And as you start recognizing patterns, then when you are in future games, you can draw on that knowledge and say, okay, in this particular game, tempo is important. You know, you'll be able to recognize that. So that's a very good way of putting it. So when you started getting serious about Magic, what was an early challenge that you struggled with, but that you eventually overcame?
To be fair, the greatest challenge I've had has been qualifying for the Pro Tour. I've been labeled in Denmark as cursed. Until I made top 8 in Utrecht, because I think Utrecht was my 7th match playing for a Pro Tour qualification.
Ooh.
Lifetime. And I've had some stingers, let's put it that way.
So what was it? Was it just like, I don't know, like poor deck selection, bad matchups? Like, I mean, what was it that was just, you know, keeping you from breaking through?
Well, I mean, I kept getting to the finals and losing.
Right.
And from what I've been told, I mean, I know that in one of them, I lost to a player that was just far superior to me. That this goes back in the day when I was a kid. I know that in two of them, I got unreasonably unlucky. And otherwise, just, I mean, it's the way the game breaks. Sometimes you lose 7 important Magic matches in a row. That's just what happens.
But then you make it. You get your breakthrough, and that's awesome. That's what we want to talk about, you know, as part of this interview, is diving into how you did what you did and leading up to it, you know, what it looked like. Before we get to that, though, I would love to dive into two more stories. The first one being your worst magic moment, and what did you learn from that experience?
My worst magic moment was, I think it goes in two moments because it felt equally horrible. It was the two PTQ finals that I've lost since I came back, where in one of them, one of them actually taught me to take magic a little less serious, if that makes any sense. Okay, like, yeah. Not feel the weight of the world on my shoulders whenever I was almost qualifying for the Pro Tour or almost qualifying for everything. I felt really, really, really dissatisfied after losing. It was a modern PTQ. It was like 200 people. And I was playing Birthing Pod. I was playing Get Infect in the final. And I actually felt terrible for doing this. I'd played my semifinal against an old friend of mine who's also playing Infect. And I misunderstood an interaction between two cards. And I asked the judge, is this how this interaction works? But without knowing it, I accidentally phrased it in a way that the judge would have to say, yes. And seeing as I did it in front of my friend, who, by the way, at the time didn't play much Magic, so he wasn't really that into what was going on, he ended up just taking the judge's word for it instead of asking the head judge, because I was wrong.
Oh, interesting.
So ultimately, I end up getting a win that I really kind of didn't deserve. And actually, that might have been because I was quite ashamed of that, actually. Like, the way that happened, because I felt it... I don't know, it just didn't feel right. And then I went on to lose the finals, which felt even worse because I had a good matchup and I played well and I just didn't get there.
Wow, yeah. So that's very interesting. You know, I've never heard, you know, that kind of situation pop up before. What did you take away from that, you know? Like, so obviously now looking back, you recognize what happened and you say you feel bad about it. What did you learn? Like, what can we learn from that?
I think what you can learn is that you should always take your own judge calls to the judge and ask the question the way that you want to ask it.
Okay, interesting.
And to make sure to double check things like that, because people will, and I felt terrible for what I'd done afterwards, actually, and just people will sometimes get you, intentionally or not, will get you on some sort of technicality. And just, it taught me, at least, the opponent that the lesson that I think my opponent should have learned if he cared to, was that you should take things to the head judge if you want to. Like, do the appeal if you want to. If it seems wrong, appeal.
Right, right. That's a really good point. You know, kind of, yeah, what we can learn from almost the other side is, like you said, feel free to call the judge yourself and appeal if you want to, because that process is there for a reason. It's not like you're a bad guy or anything like that. It's there. Use it. You know, you can ask the judge a question, then you can ask a head judge if you want to, and then have him settle it. And that's great. Like, I really appreciate you, you know, sharing that. And like you said, sometimes it's an honest mistake. You know, one player doesn't understand, and maybe the judge is a little confused, and the outcome is wrong. And sometimes people might try and get you on technicality, and they're doing it maliciously. I really believe that there are a lot more of the first, you know, honest mistakes than there are the second, but the second does exist. There are people out there who, you know, do cheat and do try and catch people and rules lawyer, we hear that and stuff like that, try and angle people. So just, you know, prodigies, be aware and be advised. And this isn't to scare you, it's just to let you know, hey, there's a process that exists. You can call a judge and then you can appeal and use that process to the best of its ability, because, you know, you don't want to end up with a win that you didn't deserve, and you don't want to give the other guy a win that they didn't deserve, you know, because somebody didn't understand, you know, interaction. So awesome. Casper, thank you so much for sharing that. The flip side, obviously, are our highs and our proud magic moments. So what has been your proudest magic moment to date?
Making top 8 in new tricks.
Nice. What did that feel like? What did that mean for you?
If you go and watch the video coverage on Twitch, I think it's fairly evident from the change in my facial expression. Because I'm known to be, like, I mean, I used to play poker. I'm fairly good at reining in my emotions. Mm-hmm. And I have never actually, I don't even know, expressed emotion from winning a Magic tournament before.
Yeah.
Except for when I won round 15.
That's awesome.
Grand Prix Utrecht. I've always labeled this as my proudest achievement. I once beat Kai Buddha in a gunslinging match back in Copenhagen prior to it. prior to an Onslaught Limited Grand Prix, I think it was. And he happened to be friends with Sven Gjertsen, who was the best Danish player at the time. And he brought him to the local game store. They, I don't know, I guess they bought him some food or whatever. And he came there to gunsling for a day or for an evening. And I just came in there as a 14-year-old kid or something. And I brought my Psychotalk deck. And I told Kai to pick up the Psychotalk deck and play against me. And then I beat Kai in what was at the time probably the most challenging mirror in the format, mm-hmm. in a very, very long game. And some of the other kids were getting kind of pissed because the game took forever. And I just remember feeling like really happy. And that one booster pack that I got from beating Kai Buddha was worth all the marbles.
Yes, that's awesome. Oh, man, that's a much better success story than mine. The only time I've ever done gunslinging was actually against Brian Kibler. And I did not know who he was. Like, I went to a pre-release. It was like a pre-release or whatever. You know, so one of my first ones or whatever. And he was there. And, you know, the same thing. You win. You get a pack or whatever. And so I signed up. And it's my turn. I go and I sat down. And obviously, I could tell he was important because otherwise he wouldn't be doing this little event if he wasn't, like, somebody, right? But I didn't know. And I basically was like, who are you? And he was very gracious and whatever. You know, it's kind of hard to talk about yourself sometimes, but he was very gracious and said who he was. And I don't remember if he mentioned he was in the Hall of Fame or not, but he was very humble, very good guy. Anyway, so we played and I got him down to one, like one or three life, something very, very small. I think it was one life. I just needed to get him. And he stabilized and pulled through and won. And I was like, unbelievable. I was just so shocked and so impressed. And so yeah, that's my gunslinging story. I actually lost to Brian Kibler, and that's cool that you won against Kai Buddha. That's cool. That's really cool. So that's awesome. I love that you finally made it to the Pro Tour. Which Pro Tour are you going to be going to?
I'm on Cats in 2.5 weeks.
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, that's going to be right around the corner when this goes live. That is amazing. So let's do it. Let's dive into how you did it. So we basically would love to talk about you know, your preparation. Like, ideally, what does preparation look like? Like, how far advanced are you choosing your deck? What are you doing leading up to it? What format was GP Utrecht?
It was standard.
Perfect. Okay. So, what did you do? How did you prepare for this Grand Prix?
I actually think I want to start it back at GP Madrid. Okay, November perfect. Last year, I think. I lost round 15 for top 8 in that one, too.
Okay. Was that number 7?
No, that was number 6, and number 7 was Utrecht that I then won.
Okay, got it. Oh, so on your 7th try, you made it, so back. Okay, yeah. Got it. Okay, go for it.
But basically what happened, going into GP Madrid, I've been a play-the-best-deck kind of guy.
Yep.
Always, more or less. I don't see too much value, except for in very new formats, such as what we're going into in Amonkhet, to try to angle the best deck. So basically what I did going into GP Madrid was I followed the metagame, I followed all the streams, I followed everything, and I was like, okay, there is this black-green Delirium deck that gets trounced by this Marvel deck, which gets somewhat trounced by this blue-white deck, and then there are a lot of people that says the blue-white deck gets trounced by the black-green deck, but I see a lot of the people that I consider to be important in the Magic environment saying that that analysis is actually wrong. And that the reason that it turns out that way is because if there is any sort of lack in skill level on the blue-white side, it gets punished really hard.
Okay.
So I was like, okay, well, I think the blue-white deck, from experience, I think the blue-white deck looks like a better deck, all in all, than both the Marvel deck and the black-green deck. So I went, okay, so I think I'm going to play the blue-white deck, but let's test it out. So I took all of the decks for trial runs. I didn't play much with the Marvel deck because, quite frankly, I hate that deck.
Fair enough.
I didn't like it. I didn't think it was very good. I think that the newer iterations that came out at that tournament was much better than the ones I had access to previously. But what I basically did was, okay, I really do like playing the blue-white deck. I really do like the way that all matchups work, and I feel like when I'm playing my A game, I can have an edge in all matchups. So I was like, okay, now what I really need to do is I need to figure out what's going to show up at this tournament and how to beat them. So what I did was I analyzed the Magic Online metagame and I went, okay, so basically the only decks that really exist are the blue-white deck, the black-green Delirium deck, and the Marvel deck. And this was when I don't remember the guy. I don't remember the Modo account. The guy who won 1 million trophies with the black-green, black-red Marvel or green-red Marvel deck.
Okay. I don't know.
That was when he was sort of on his rise with the Marvel deck. So I was like, okay, I'm going to play this deck. I need to figure out what's important in these matchups. So I had the I thought that I had the black-green matchup figured out quite well already. I had come to the conclusion of how many revolutionary rebuffs I had to have and all those kind of things. I'd sort of gotten there, but I was a little bit iffy on the blue-white matchup. So what I basically did was I took two blue-white decks and I went to a friend's place and I jammed blue-white mirrors for 5 hours straight. Huh. And when I was done, I knew exactly when you could cast your Spellqueller, when you could cast your Gideons, when you could cast your Avacyns, when you could attack, when you couldn't, all that sort of nonsense. So I went and did that for GP Madrid. I had a really good success story there. I came home from GP Madrid and I was like, oh, well, I was 7-2 at day one. I felt like I'd gotten kind of both lucky, and I had a ridiculous game against the blue-white Fevered Visions deck where somehow I survived for like 7 turns at 1 life with him having a Fevered Visions in play. Oh, and gosh. But on the other hand, I'd also lost 2 matches to just straight up flooding and screwing 2 games. So I was 7-2, suddenly I was 12-2, and then I lost to a bad matchup and a little bit of bad luck. And I came home, I was really hungry. It's like, okay, like I really feel like I'm playing better than I was before. I've been putting a lot of work into my game, not just into playing, but also into actually getting better. My mental state was better. Like, I really felt like I was getting there. So I went to a couple of limited GPs, and then then came up Utrecht, and I was like, there are 3 decks. There are the Saheeli decks, the Black-Green deck, and the Mardu deck. And Mardu had won the Pro Tour. Black-Green had won the GP that took place 2 weeks prior to Utrecht. With Ryan Hare won that one with the black-green deck. And I looked at his list and I was like, I kind of like this list, except there are a couple of choice cards that I think hurt you too much on tempo in the game to be viable. So I cut those out. I made some exchanges on the creature base. And I just jammed, basically. I had good results against both 4-color Saheeli decks and Mardu decks, and Marvel wasn't really a thing. And so I had good online results. I had good live testing results with friends. I gave my list to 2 of my friends who both scrubbed out at day one. And then, yeah, I go to the tournament and I just sort of, every round, I just sort of sat down and played. I didn't think much of it. I just sat down and played. I lost 1 match in a fairly unlucky fashion on day one. I lost 1 match where I just got trounced by a 4-color deck. And after round eight, this is my second loss. And I go like, huh, there's a PTQ tomorrow. And to me, what mattered when I went to GPs was qualifying to the Pro Tour and winning the GP. Those were basically the 2 important things. Winning the $250 was nice if it was a backup plan. But if there was a PTQ, I'd rather play that than play at 6-3.
Okay, yeah,
so
good point.
So after I lose round 8, I actually rush to the information booth because I lose round 8 at like -2 minutes on the clock. So I rush to the information booth because I hear that the PTQ is selling out pretty quickly, and I register for the Sunday PTQ.
Nice.
Because I was like, well, if I lose round 9, I want to be able to play the PTQ, yada, yada, yada. And then obviously I win round 9. I still actually consider if it's better to play the PTQ for like a brief second. I try to run some math in my head, come to the conclusion that it can't possibly be better. And then I go and get my refund for my PTQ seat.
Oh, that's cool that they let you do that. That's good.
Well, they sort of realized that there was about 800 people still playing in the GP that could maybe make day 2, or that would maybe like to change their minds and all this stuff. And there were millions of people wanting to play the the PTQ. So getting it sold out regardless was not going to be a problem.
Yeah, yeah.
So they allowed us to do this. So I went and got my refund. I went home to our hotel room with my 2 friends, watched some ridiculous movie on local TV, and basically just went to bed, woke up the next morning. I was like, oh, well, I'm 7-2. I need to 6-0 to qualify for the Pro Tour. That's basically what I need to do. And so I sit down and I play, and I beat a friend of ours from England in round 1 of day 2 because his Mardu deck just completely malfunctions. And then round 2 of day 2, I think this is where I get paired against Jeremy Desani, who I happen to have seen play And he was playing the Temur Tower deck with Fumigates in it. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting there with my black-green creatures, and I was like, ugh. Because I'd been having a pretty hard time in testing against specifically the Temur Tower deck.
Okay.
And I was just like, well, Fumigates can't possibly make it better for me, can they? And then I played three games versus Jeremy Ware. Game one, I mulligan to six. I keep Winding Constrictor, Sylvan Advocate, and two lands.
All right.
And then I scry a Rishkar to the top of my library, and I miss my land on turn three, play my second Constrictor. Jeremy sees a shot to actually get his Dynavolt Tower onto the table. I rip my land and kill him in two hits.
Oh my goodness, that's a lot of plus one counters.
that was really dumb. Then I lose a very close game two, and Jeremy sort of fizzles out in game three. Mm-hmm. And then I get to play another terrible matchup in the blue-red Emerge deck the round thereafter. And I get incredibly lucky against a guy who... Well, against Thomas Hendricks, a gold pro from Holland, I think, mm-hmm. from the Netherlands. And then just... I was sitting there like, I just seem to keep getting lucky. Like, I'd been hitting... I'd admittedly been really lucky already at this point. I'd been really good at keeping hands without either Rishkar or Winding Constrictor, and somehow still having both in play on turn three.
Ooh.
I'd been really good at that.
Just drawing into him.
Yeah. So yeah, what basically happened was that I kept on winning on just either on ridiculous things. I had a match against the four color Saheeli deck where both of us just kind of looked at each other and was like, yeah, this was not fun. We were done after the match score was 2-1. We were done after like 12 minutes.
Oh my goodness.
Because in game one, I played a 2-drop, I played a Nissa, I played a Winding Constrictor and a Walking Ballista, and the guy could never ever win.
Huh. Wow.
And in game two, he played turn three Saheeli Rai, I played a Sylvan Advocate, I transgressed the Minded, fell into a Guardian out of his hand, and he drew another one from the top and killed me.
Yep.
And in game three, I did the exact same thing I did in game one.
Oh my gosh.
And both of us were just, we were like a little dejected at this point, because we were like, yeah, this is just... like, really dumb.
This is not Magic.
Like,
yeah.
Like, really, really dumb, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. Fast forward, I end up in round 15 against Pierre Summon, one of the nicest guys I've ever played against, I think. And the matchup for me at this point, I'd spend a lot of time building this green-black list and tuning it so that it would be good in the mirror. And I'd specifically very much avoided many of the synergies in order to just have better cards, which I think was relevant, but his deck just sort of, I mean, he mulliganed the five in game two and never really has a chance.
That's incredible. Like, I love that story, you know, hearing how your preparation, your process started way back at the GP before, and how you were really into evaluating the meta and seeing where things were going and making decision, putting in the time. Like you talked about going and playing, you know, that blue-white mirror for 5 hours at your friend's just so you can understand that deck and how it lines up and when you can play this, that, and the other, and just really understanding. And then taking all of that knowledge and that dedication into the next GP where you identified the deck that you wanted to play and you just practice a lot with it. And understanding, and you know, we've heard this before where people say, hey, you know, there is an amount of luck that goes into making it to you know, the top eight, but that does not discount the fact that preparation and practice pays off. You know, like you just said, you did put a lot of time into playtesting and tuning the deck against the mirror and, you know, making sure that you understood every single card that was in your deck and why and how to sideboard. And you were prepared for these matchups, like, you know, you knew which ones were bad, which ones were good, and some of them you know drew well, and some of them your opponents drew bad, but that's how Magic is, you know. And you did your part in getting ready. I love it.
Yeah, I mean you can't control the luck factor of Magic. So what you can do is try to control the other factors.
Yes, absolutely. Man, so that's awesome. We, you know, congratulations again on making it. I'm so pumped for you. How are you going to prepare, or how are you preparing, since we're in the window, for the Pro Tour? Like, you know, this pops up every now and again. People who make it to their, you know, they've done their first top eight, they're going to their first Pro Tour. What's that like? You know, like, do you have Pro Tour, other Pro Tour people that you're meeting up with? Like, how do you prepare for your first Pro Tour? What are you going to do?
I actually think that out of all Pro Tours that I could have qualified for, this was probably, initially at least, the worst option I had.
Oh no.
Because for the last Pro Tour, Simon Nielsen, Danish gold pro, currently leading our national ranking for captaincy and such, He sort of just gathered all the other Danish players to test with and a couple of the Swedes. And I would have slotted really well. I know all those guys pretty well, and they know me pretty well. And I would have slotted really well into that sort of dynamic.
Right.
But what then ended up happening was that zero of the players who only had one invite then ended up requalifying.
Oh, no.
And when that happened, Simon went, yeah, I'm going to test with MTG Mint Card next Pro Tour. I was like, I understand that. I would have done the same in your spot. And then suddenly I top 8 Utrecht. And I'm like, what do I do now?
Yeah. So what do you do now?
Well, I actually initially, I have a pretty good group of friends here. I'm good friends with Oscar Christensen, Marcus Hensing. You did an interview with Marcus as well.
Yeah.
Great top 8 in London. Yeah. I'm really good friends with some of those guys. So I actually had a pretty good background to help me, who was willing to help me. So I was fairly comfortable in that and just going into that. And then suddenly I get a message from Simon saying like, hey, dude, there's this team of just pretty much random people that you've never met before, but that I know and that I, at least some of them, I can vouch for, that are sort of looking to fill out their ranks, and I told them that you'd be a good fit, and they're interested. Do you want to talk to them? I was like, that sounds fun. It sounds better than going to Nashville on my own and just being there alone. So Simon goes and puts me into contact with one of them, and I go look at the Facebook profile of the guy that I'm trying to get in contact with, and I'm like, oh my God. Because this is a guy that I beat in a PPTQ final at 1 o'clock at night, because it was the same weekend as the RPTQ, and it started at 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Oh no! Wow.
So it's like, but the guy I have met, his name is Matti. He is qualified through 11 and 5 in Dublin, and he's actually a really nice guy.
Awesome.
So I talk with him, and I get invited to this group. So now we actually have a team. Now people are actively testing on the beta. People are actively brewing decks. We've made limited rankings, that kind of stuff already.
Man, that's awesome. I'm glad that you got linked up with, you know, a group of people who are actually going. Like you said, it sure beats, you know, traveling alone. So have you been to the States before?
No, never.
All right. So yeah, so it definitely beats going to a new country all by yourself. And you mentioned Marcus, a friend of yours. He was episode 143. So those of you who want to go back and listen to him, he was episode 143. Great guy, like I said. And so that's cool. I just love, you know, how international this podcast is and talking to players from all over the world. So my wife is actually from Tennessee, a little like 2 hours away from Nashville. But, you know, I've flown into there a couple times. And so it's very pretty. You're going to like it a lot. It's a very pretty part of the country. So that's cool.
Yeah, I mean, now we have a house and all that stuff there. So
do you just go on Airbnb, or how do you find a place to stay when you're going to another country?
That's very dependent on where I'm going and how long I'm going to be there for.
Yeah.
In this case, I didn't really do a lot of the looking. The other guys on the team did.
Yeah. Usually somebody on the team will be in charge of that, and you know they'll
spearhead. I imagine that's how it works pretty much all the time. I know that when I go to GPs, I usually just book hotel rooms.
Okay.
And I oftentimes look for hotel rooms with breakfast.
Smart.
Because I think that's actually important, that you get decent breakfast when you go to a GP. I think that a lot of people would benefit a lot from not eating some sort of half-baked sandwich from the local whatever place.
Right. Now, do you stay as close to the event as you can? Is paying the extra worth it is what I'm trying to ask.
That depends how much paying the extra is and how much closer it gets you.
Okay.
Because, I mean, in Prague, we lived 3 metro stops away from the site.
Okay.
And because we stayed at the same site, the same hotel as the judges, I think. And because we went those 3 metro stops away, we saved like almost $100.
Right.
And no, paying to not take that 10-minute train ride in the morning is not worth it.
Right.
To me, at least.
Yeah, like 10 minutes is not a big of a deal, but if it's like 40 minutes or something like that, then you might want to...
I mean, I don't think I'd do that. I don't think I'd go that far away.
Right.
Pretty much ever.
Yeah, you know, so 10 minutes, whether it's by public transportation or walking, is really not the end of the world. But if it's like 40 minutes and like traffic, then yeah, it's just, yeah, you might want to pay to be a little bit closer. So
I mean... In GP Stockholm, we happen to have a friend who lives in Uppsala, which is about 45 minutes by car away from Stockholm. And that was actually kind of bad. Like,
interesting.
It was great. It was during summer vacation last year. It was great staying there. We had a lot of fun. But going there in the morning kind of sucked.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a bit of a drive. See, that's very interesting. I love getting that little insight, you know, the behind the scenes stuff. You know, in addition to taking care of your deck and everything, you have to do all the logistics and stuff. And it's neat, especially, you know, European players like you constantly traveling to different countries, different places. You know, it's fun to get that perspective. So very cool. So back on the topic of, you know, playing Magic and your experience and just, you know, sitting across a table from so many different people, what's the biggest mistake that you see players make? And then how can we avoid that mistake?
Underestimating themselves, underestimating their own chances.
Really? How so?
I think a lot of people, this goes mainly when they go up against top level competition, like known competition in specifics. I see a lot of people make uncharacteristic or just very odd mistakes that I can't for the life of me imagine they do if they're not to some degree nervous about the guy they're playing against. Mm-hmm. I think that a lot of people sort of, and I've seen it actually, like locally, there tend to be local superheroes in all local game stores.
The end boss of the store.
The end boss of the local game store. They'll typically be like somewhere slightly below the Grand Prix grinders in terms of play skill level. But in terms of the new people who show up and play against them, they seem godlike because they beat them every time. Their deck's always good. Like, they play the meta decks. They play them to a very, very reasonable extent. And some people will just get severely disheartened when they're playing against them. I was one of them for a while. And I had players sit down and play against me and go like, oh, I pretty much can't win now. And I'm sitting there looking like we're playing a game of Magic. Like, I don't think I can ever get above maybe in the most egregious games, I can maybe get above 80%, but I don't think I can ever beat 85. So saying that you can't win, just like that concept, it's very foreign to me to think that way.
Right. The defeatist mindset.
But I think that mindset is actually somewhat prevalent to some people. And
so how do we combat that? How do we not get intimidated when we sit across the table from a known player?
I said this before to some of the people that I know, and they sort of think that I'm an idiot when I say it, but I think that a little bit of hubris is actually a good idea in a Magic player. Not to the way that you become obnoxious and that you believe you're better than everything and everyone all the time. You need to be able to reflect on what you're doing if you want to improve. But I think that if you have just the right degree of hubris, that when you sit down, regardless of who sits down against you, your only thought is, I'm going to beat this guy or this woman, then I think that having just exactly that amount of hubris is enough, or is one of the most important things in order to have the confidence whenever you sit down and play. I think it's also something that comes with experience, comes with having sat down in front of people who are the best in the game before having maybe beaten them. Even if you've beaten them in a somewhat lucky fashion, it still amps up that benefit. And I mean, I definitely, when I sat down against Jeremy Dizani at GP Utrecht, I went to GP Prague, and I just got the pairing of round 4 Ben Stark, round 5 Alexander Hain.
Well, there you go.
And I beat Ben, and I lost to Alex, and then I beat Martin Jusa in round 9.
Wow. Yeah.
My deck was really good. But just getting those experiences under your belt is really a way to combat it.
Yeah.
And then maybe also just kind of, I don't know, just try to work on your own mindset, just your own mental state, really.
I love it. That's so good. I totally agree. I think that's great. You know, recognizing where your pitfalls are and then working on yourself, working on your mindset and having that bit of confidence, you know, sitting down and being, you know, I can do this, you know, I can beat this player in front of me, or I am going to beat this player in front of me, you know? And, like you said, just a little bit, not to where you're obnoxious or anything like that, but just a little bit can go a long way. I really think that is so true. Awesome. So what is your best format?
I guess results would say that it's standard.
Excellent. And we've talked a little bit about how you go into, you know, that process of identifying, you know, a deck and practicing and whatnot. But right now, when we are on the tipping, you know, we're on the verge of a new set and there's going to be new cards coming in. Let's talk a little bit about that. What are some of your advice? What are some tips, you know, when we're looking at a brand new standard? How do you figure out what's good and what's not good right here at the beginning? What do you say?
I think that one of the most important things is to just not get too fancy if avoidable. I see a lot of decks becoming unnecessarily fancy for no real apparent reason. And once you...
Other than they want to play new cards.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, but also just, I mean, we saw some of the improvised decks at the previous Pro Tour, at Pro Tour Aether Revolt, that just... Those decks were just a lot of wheels that were spinning, and they could do some really powerful stuff, but they could also do a lot of very nothing. And I think avoiding those kind of things, at least that's an opinion I have, that avoiding those kind of behaviors, if you have one of those decks, you need to test it enough to have a reasonable reason to say, I think this deck is broken. Because those decks, what you get with those decks is you get the broken decks, or you get the garbage can, right?
Yeah.
So I think that if you have a deck that is that way, you can look at it like this. You say, I want to gamble on this deck. But I really think that at least if you have access to other people to test with and have access to what I'd characterize as a decent amount of manpower between you to really hash out, like, does this deck actually win its games, or does it just have an insane nut draw, or what exactly is the deal with this deck? I think hashing that out is probably the most important. And I also think that for like 85% of us, going for reactive strategies in the early days of formats is usually wrong. Okay. Occasionally there'll be cards that are just egregiously overpowered that will push you into that direction. But generally, I think going for proactive strategies early in a format is typically where you'd want to be.
That's interesting. And why is that? Is that because... The other guys who are trying to be reactive and don't have things figured out yet, you can kind of run over them as if you are a little faster.
It's just if a format is unknown, knowing what to answer is so much harder than just actually asking a question.
Good point. I like that.
Like if the control player doesn't know if he's answering like Gideon's or. Winding Constrictors, or maybe he's answering Dynavolt Towers.
Right, or some new Sphinx that we don't know if is good or not, you know? Yeah, that's a really good point. Do I save this for this thing, or, you know, do I counter the turn 4 play, or the turn 5, or do I need it on turn 7? That's a really good point. And so if you're proactive, you don't have to ask those questions. You just put stuff down and turn it sideways.
Yeah, I mean, of course there's more to it than that.
There is, there is.
I think that's an old... A little bit of an unfortunate myth that fortunately is getting debunked slowly, that the control players, like the best players, would pick the control decks. That's an old school myth from back when I first played.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, that's getting debunked rather rapidly. Mm-hmm. Guys like Paul Rietzel, who played a lot of aggro decks very expertly, has fortunately helped in debunking these things.
Totally.
But yeah, I think that doing that and then... Like I said, just minimize the complication, especially if you don't have a lot of time to work on it. Not all people, like now suddenly I'm in a group of 9 people that are playing and talking about Magic literally all day. Mm-hmm. We have a guy from Australia on our team, which means that we have access to talk about Magic about 18 hours a day if we want to.
That's awesome. That's awesome. What a good resource. That's really neat. Yeah, so that's another thing, you know, find a group. Whether it's a small group or a big group, you know, find a group that's passionate and start talking about it, you know, play tests and proxy things up and, you know, talk about it with other people. And that's how these big teams start figuring out new sets. And there's nothing to say that you can't do that too with your friends. You know, it might be done on a smaller scale than some of these big teams, but you can still do it. And doing that process yourself, you learn so much more than just waiting for the results of someone else's research. You know, you might come to the same conclusion, but if you went through the process yourself, you'll have all of that, all those steps that you took to get there. So you know why X is better than Y or whatever, as opposed to just taking someone else's word, oh, X is better than Y, but you don't really know, you don't understand the nuances. So.
Exactly.
Yeah, super cool. Man, this has been awesome. I've absolutely loved this. You know, learning a little bit about you and where you're at and your favorites and going into, you know, some of your ups and your downs. And then I love your story of your top 8 and how you got there, some of your matches and stuff, and really what it took to get there. This has been absolutely awesome. Some speculations as to what to do on a new set. because we're right here around the corner, and this has been great. A couple more questions to wrap things up. What are some magic-related resources that you recommend? Like, where do you turn to when you're keeping up with what's going on?
I generally just go to Twitch. I think that there's so much good magic content on Twitch. So many streamers. The magic coverage is actually a good way, at least if you want to keep up on sort of the metagames of things, is a good way. And the way that I watch magic when I watch magic is if I could, I would hide the hands of at least one player. Nice. And I would try to figure out what's actually going on from a player perspective, which is, it's very hard to do that objectively. Yeah. If you can see both hands.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's actually incredibly hard to do that perfectly objectively. But I try to do stuff like that. I think Channel Fireball produces absolutely excellent content. There's a lot of excellent players in there. There's a lot of players for all different kinds of things also. There are a lot of players that are... I mean, there's a lot of different videos, really, on there that appeals to different people. Some people like Reed Duke's way of explaining things. Some people like Owen Turdenwald. Some people like Paulo Vitor's.
Good. Those are great resources. Twitch.tv and then Channel Fireball for sure. Quick reminder to the Prodigies, if you want to connect with Casper, you can do so on Twitter. He's at @KS_Nielsen, so look him up there. And Casper, what is one last parting piece of guidance you have for us? Either something you already said you want to emphasize or something new you want to leave with us here at the end.
Let's see here. I think it's important for people to remember to have fun when they play Magic. I think that for me personally, I sort of lost that for a brief moment. Once or twice or maybe thrice in the times I've played Magic, where it's like, man, I really want to get to the Pro Tour, but playing these Pro Tour qualifiers is not actually really fun for me right now. And I think that the way to combat this is that if Magic just literally isn't fun for you right now, it could be because of external factors, there could be something going on at work, your girlfriend could be pregnant, whatever. There are a million things that factor into why we enjoy the things we enjoy. But if you don't enjoy playing Magic, I think trying to force it is the wrong way about it. I think that brute forcing yourself to overplay Magic is probably wrong. I also think that just like high-level commitment-based competitive Magic, I just don't think it's for everyone. I don't think everyone enjoys it the same way that I do, for instance.
That's a great point. Thank you so much for reminding us to remember to have fun. Like that is, yeah, that should be at the key, that should be at the base of our motivations for playing Magic.
I mean, that's why we play, right? The people who are hyper competitive play so much Magic and they do so much work in testing because, quite frankly, they enjoy doing the work. Mm-hmm. And the most important thing to them is to win. And then there are the people who play kitchen table Magic, who go to a tournament once in a while and just get the most out of whatever you do with Magic, because at the end of the day, it's a hobby.
Mm-hmm. Love it. Absolutely love it. And Casper, I want to acknowledge you for your contributions to the multiverse. And thank you so much for your time and for sharing your experiences with us today. You are a hero among planeswalkers, and it has been a blast chatting with you. May you never be mana screwed. Always draw what you need and depart every plane victorious.
Thank you very much.
Once again, Casper, thank you so much for taking the time to come onto the show. I really appreciate it. Prodigies, I hope you learned as much as I did. And as always, you know where to go. The show notes will be at mtgprotutor.com/Casper Nielsen. So just put in his name there and you'll find the show notes. And we always like to link to resources that were mentioned, so feel free to look that up and check those out. Thanks again to this episode's sponsors, the patrons over at mtgprotutor.com/Patreon. It really does mean a lot to me, and I would not be able to keep the show going without the patrons. So thank you, thank you, thank you. And deckbuildingmasterclass.com. If you are interested in a free PDF download where we break down the process that some of the best deck builders in the game go through when they are attacking a meta, then go to deckbuildingmasterclass.com and you can download the free PDF there. Thanks so much for joining me today. I cannot wait to get together again this Friday for our next episode. And I would also love to hear all about your pre-release. Tell me where you went, what promo did you get, what deck did you build, what cards were good, what cards were not good. Let's just have a cool discussion about this new Amonkhet set in the Facebook group. So, once again, I'm so happy you joined me today. Cannot wait to do it again next time. I am Sean of The Gathering, and we will see you in the next cast.
This round of MTG Pro Tutor is over. So you don't miss a single episode of MTG Mastery. Be sure to subscribe to the show on your preferred podcast listening service for more exclusive interviews, deck building tips, and elite content. Or visit mtgprotutor.com to stream it straight from the source. We look forward to helping you think and play like a pro.